This is Arts Alive for this Saturday, February 6th. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Today, when a group of Asian American actors got tired of being offered stereotypical roles like the Dragon Lady or the gang member, they formed East-West Players, a company still going strong 50 years later.
What they wanted to do was to show the rest of Hollywood that they could do Shakespeare, they could do Chekhov, and eventually they branched out into playwriting where our own stories from the Asian countries and from Asian America started to grow.
Tim Dang is the artistic director of East-West Players. More with him about the company and the tearful profession at the center of their upcoming world premiere in a moment. Also on the program today, Christy Edmonds says artists stretch the fence line of what's familiar to us. Our conversation with the executive and artistic director for the Center for the Art of Performance at UCLA later in today's program. And on Ask the Dean, do any classically trained singers work outside the world of opera? That's the question for Dean Rob Kudieta of the USC Thornton School of Music. First, here's Alan Chapman with the Arts News.
From the Arts Desk today, another post for Mirga, a new hire with vision at the California African American Museum, and Fleming says goodbye to the main stage. Lithuanian conductor Mirga Gražinytė Tyla was just named associate conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, but LA is going to have to share her with the UK. Mirga, the press often calls her by just her first name, Mirga is the new music director of the City of Birmingham Symphony. Gustavo Dudamel says she's an amazing artist. The UK newspaper The Guardian reviewed a concert she conducted in Birmingham and said she really did communicate something wonderfully alive and detailed to the players. She'll officially begin the 3-year post in September. Mirga also holds a music directorship in Austria at the Salzburg Landestheater. We'll next see her in Disney Hall on March 1st when she leads a program with the LA Phil New Music Group. The California African American Museum in Los Angeles has a new deputy director. Naima J. Keith will leave the Studio Museum in Harlem to take the post. It won't be her first time in local museums. A show Keith curated at the Studio Museum featuring the work of artist Charles Gaines traveled here to the Hammer Museum last year. With this appointment, the California African American Museum brings a nationally recognized curator to the institution. The executive director of the museum told the LA Times that Keith was an impressive candidate and that he hopes her vision will help transform the museum and bring new audiences to Exposition Park to visit the California African American Museum. Renee Fleming says next season will be her last when it comes to mainstream opera appearances. The Telegraph reported this week that the opera superstar is not ready to retire completely, but she doesn't want to repeat roles she's performed before, only for it to be said she did them better in previous years. So, Fleming says, after performances of Rosenkavalier at Covent Garden and the Met next season, she'll turn her focus away from the main stage. She also hinted at a major appointment to be announced in the next month. That's the Arts News for Saturday, February 6th. On this date in 1903, pianist Claudio Arrau was born in Chillán, Chile. In his career, Arrau became known for his interpretations of everything from Baroque to contemporary pieces. He once said about his early years, "All I wanted was music. I was even fed at the piano. I used to play with my mouth open, and my mother put food in it." For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. East-West Players is a little Tokyo institution in the middle of celebrating its 50th season. The company is known for productions dramatizing a diversity of storylines from a variety of Asian and Asian American communities. But in the beginning, the founding members wanted to prove they could tackle the classics as well as anyone else. Artistic director Tim Dang spoke with KUSC's Kelsey McConnell about the origin and evolution of East-West Players.
Back in 1965, there were 8 actors and 1 technical advisor that founded East-West Players. There were so many graduates from well-known schools, and they were relegated to these roles. They were the stereotypical roles like the Dragon Lady or the gang member. What they wanted to do was to show the rest of Hollywood that they could do meaty roles, that they could do Shakespeare, they could do Chekhov, and that's how East-West Players got started, and eventually they branched out into playwriting What's very interesting to note is that America's demographics have changed a lot, and especially in Southern California, where we're already a majority-minority population. The stories of these minorities were not necessarily being told on the main stages of Southern California. And so the kinds of programming that East West Players has produced, you can say is pretty forward-looking. There's a lot of immigrant stories. There's a lot of multiracial stories told in a way where this is part of the new America.
Your average audience demographic, that was interesting. 56% Asian and 44% not Asian.
That's right. That's right. I think what it is that our audience really wants to learn and know about other cultures. LA is already this melting pot, and theater is actually one way to explore other cultures in a very interactive way, but at the same time, you know, you're not necessarily traveling to China, to Japan, to Indonesia, but you're actually sitting right here in Los Angeles and you're experiencing this international story.
You've been with East West Players for over 20 years. What brought you there in the first place?
Actually, it was my senior advisor at the USC School of Theater told me that my life as an actor was not going to be easy for me being a person of color and being of Asian descent. So he thought that I should get together with this band of actors and that they were making headway into what was called the Hollywood culture. And so I actually joined them upon graduating from USC and have been with them ever since. And I learned everything from not just acting, but stage management, lighting, box office, and eventually I became the organization's artistic director in 1993.
You're about to open a new production, and it's a world premiere called Criers for Hire. And it centers around a profession that I must admit didn't know existed.
Well, in the Chinese culture, there is this custom where you want to present to the people attending a funeral that the person who died was well-loved. And what the family does is that they hire these professional criers who do it for a living to cry at these funerals.
And so this play, Criers for Hire, it's about a family that tries to import that tradition to
That's
the
right.
U.S.
That's right. The mother is making a living here in Southern California, in Los Angeles, and is trying to bring her daughter from the Philippines to come and live with her. When her daughter does come on over to Los Angeles, she begins to teach her daughter how to cry at funerals. The opposite happens, and she starts laughing. It's this whole comedy of errors. And while we employ a lot of Filipino actors, they never really get a chance to play themselves. So this was one commission where we could actually cast Filipinos to play their own ethnicity. And this happens to be a comedy, basically in English, but there's a little bit of Tagalog, which is a Filipino dialect. And so they call it Taglish. The playwright is Giovanni Ortega. He is from the Philippines. He is actually a professor at Pomona College. And Giovanni was actually introduced to East West Players as an actor, and we slowly developed him into a writer, and so we commissioned him with this piece to do it for our main stage.
It's the 50th anniversary. What does that number mean to you?
Oh, my gosh. The organization was born out of the Watts riots back in 1965, and we weathered another riot, Los Angeles riots, in 1992. And so just knowing that we are turning a corner now where America is becoming majority-minority by the year 2042, that there is this impetus for the next chapter of East-West Players from the 51st on, in which we can probably bring a lot more realism about what America is about.
There's an argument made sometimes that maybe we're past the need for sort of niche organizations,
right,
or organizations that have,
right,
a really specific focus. How do you respond to that argument?
That is a very, very interesting question, and we are actually talking about that exact topic amongst our board of directors. We shouldn't think of a mainstream culture being at the lead of arts, that we have to think of a many-streamed thought process in which there are these multitude of stories that are being told, a blending of the cultures that truly becomes an American culture. I think that is where America's going to go.
So this is your last season with the company.
Right.
As you kind of look back over your history with them, are there things that you will just always especially remember?
Well, I'm really proud of the move that we did from the 99-seat black box to a professional 240-seat theater. I'm really proud of that. The founding artistic director, Mako, had always wanted to pay our artists a living wage with health insurance and a pension plan. That was always his dream. It was one of my goals to carry on that dream. From 1998 on, we were able to offer that living wage to artists.
What are your hopes for the company moving forward?
Funny you should ask. We were actually speaking with some major donors yesterday, along with some board members, about the growth of East-West Players. And perhaps it would be nice to have an additional space so that we could have a diversity of works happening at the same time, or to have multiple partners where we are actually performing in other parts of the city.
And the next artistic director?
Well, we're currently going to go through our search, and we hope to have someone in place within the next couple of months so that there is a time where I can help pass on the knowledge that I have onto the next artistic director.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks.
Tim Dang is the artistic director of LA's East-West Players. This season is their 50th, and it's also Dang's last with the company. The world premiere of Criers for Hire opens February 11th, and the company's final production of the season, La Cage aux Folles, opens in May. EastWestPlayers.org for tickets, and Tim Dang spoke with KUSC's Kelsey McConnell. This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Next week, The Envelope, Please. A couple of weeks early, it's our annual Oscars edition of the program. Film critic Kenneth Turan consults his crystal ball, and movie music expert John Burlingame weighs in on this year's unusual race for Best Score. It's next Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, or you can listen to past episodes anytime with the Arts Alive podcast. Find it at KUSC.org/artsalive. And if you listen to the podcast using iTunes, please consider leaving us a review. It'll help other people find Arts Alive. Coming up, how artists create cultural memory. But first, here once again is Alan Chapman with this week's Around Town Arts Calendar.
Here's a bit of what's happening around town, starting as we always do with a free event. Tomorrow afternoon at UCLA, contemporary piano and an emerging talent, pianist Susanna Bartal, will present a lecture recital of contemporary music for solo piano. That'll include works by Thomas Addis, Veronica Krauses, and others. That recital takes place tomorrow at noon in UCLA's Schoenberg Hall. More information at schoolofmusic.ucla.edu, and again, admission is free. Also free tomorrow, the Enlightenment Chamber Music Series brings some wonderful music to the Neighborhood Church of Pasadena. Their program includes works by Mozart, Schubert, Beethoven, and Poulenc. That's tomorrow at 4 p.m. at Pasadena's Neighborhood Church on Orange Grove. You can find more information at enlmusicseries.org. And again, admission is free. And tonight in Orange County, Organ Splendor with the Pacific Symphony, featuring two superstar organists, Paul Jacobs and Christoph Bull. The orchestra is joined by the Pacific Chorale for Morten Lauritsen's Lux Aeterna. A concert 8 o'clock tonight at Renee and Henry Sagerstrom Concert Hall in Costa Mesa. And please join me and our guest artists for a pre-concert conversation at 7. Tickets and information at pacificsymphony.org. And that's a bit of what's happening around town this week. For details on these and other cultural events in Southern California, visit performingartslive.com. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
Coming up, can a classically trained diva work outside the opera world? We ask the dean. But first, Christy Edmonds helped shape the art scene in Portland, Oregon, and Melbourne, Australia, before moving to L.A. 5 years ago. She's the executive and artistic director for the Center for the Art of Performance at UCLA, where, she says, they don't just invite performers to take the Royce Hall stage, they also connect artists with university resources to help both parties deepen their understanding of the world at large. Edmonds recently spoke with KUSC contributor Sheila Tepper about her goals for CAP UCLA.
As a major research university, UCLA has had, over 75 years of direct involvement in supporting and presenting the performing arts. So Royce Hall was one of the first buildings built on the campus, and from that point forward, with a fly system and really interesting acoustics, they began the process of wanting to create a hall for public assembly in which art and artists and great thinkers and ideas would be on stage on this campus, not only for the Los Angeles public, but also for the academic and student community here at UCLA. So they have an incredibly long history. It's very rare, actually, that universities have had that number of decades of involvement across the evolution of live performance forms. And so my vision is to be able to continue presenting and bringing work from our time, contemporary performance makers in theater, in dance, in the different music forms, and support them not only with the presentation of their work, but also the behind-the-scenes glimpses into what motivates the work, what inspires them, how did they develop their practice, and where their own research vitalities finding form. So sometimes we will connect somebody to the researchers in neuroscience, and that informs part of the dance vocabulary that might evolve over time. Sometimes we take a company like Batsheva, and we put them into a number of different situations where they're working in the dance department or they're working in public policy to talk about their work and to share their skills.
What do you think about the arts in L.A. and the rest of the country, for that matter, at this difficult time in funding?
Well, if you look at the scale of talent across all forms in Los Angeles, this is a major hub and wellspring of extraordinary artistry that's located here in visual art, in obviously cinema, but also too in theater and in dance and in an incredible array of music. So in a way, Los Angeles is a city that if we really focused on the artistic inhabitants here, it is completely, we're all spoiled for choice. The flip side of it is it's actually kind of difficult to find where all of these different kinds of things are going on. We're very spread out. Traffic is an issue. People operate in a variety of different kinds of ways to access the work that they want to support or participate in. But it's not a city that has lots of mass transit. And in the mass transit environment, we can use the whole of a city instead of the pockets of the neighborhood that we can most easily access. Nationally, the artistic world, it's different in different forms. I mean, in many cases, people would think in the visual arts, for example, there's a booming kind of economy in the visual arts scene. That is also very true here, hard won. Great museums, great curators, really wonderful commercial galleries, young startup galleries. There's a lot of different access points for artists to get their work out there. The performing arts, it's a little bit of a different equation. The market is not exactly booming. People are looking at, screens more and more and more in terms of accessing part of how they engage in their culture. And so I think in the performing arts, it's a slightly different animal because often people think that the ticket sales alone will cover the resource investment to make a project happen, and that's not at all the case. And so we work very hard behind the scenes to raise philanthropic support, to pursue grants so that we have enough resources to make long-term commitments to these artists of our time so that they are able to sustain their craft and their work and can join us on our stages and really be part of LA's consciousness.
what role do you think that the arts play in society?
Well, an extraordinary one over the whole of human history. I mean, the most succinct way I can put it is probably, you know, without the arts, we don't really have cultural memory. Our memory is passed through generation after generation, and artists inhabit that. They stretch the fence line of what's familiar to us. They give us, in many ways, contact with being other than ourselves and pull us from our daily lives and hopefully elevate our, as I said, consciousness, our empathy often, our sense of being rejuvenated. Sometimes artists grab us by the throat and shake us around and disrupt our complacency. And the whole overall mix of those things means that we have a cultural footprint and a cultural way of belonging to human history and heritage. And they are the arbiters of making sure that that continues into the future. So to me, if we don't have the arts, we don't have a cultural memory.
Now, I know that you were in Philadelphia, and you have a very interesting involvement there. Tell us something about it.
Well, I was, you know, very blessed to be asked to be a scholar in residence with the Pew Center for Art and Heritage for a year, which meant that I was based in L.A., but I was going back and forth to Philadelphia, where the Pew Center is, to work with them, to work with their grantees, to look at the lay of the land of what's going on in Philadelphia, and really deeply get to know the arts community there and the various things that they're doing, as well as looking at the Pew Center itself, which is not just a foundation that makes grants. It's really a center that stimulates, helps to economize, in a way kind of co-makes meaning for arts resourcing in Philadelphia and the kind of five-county region beyond.
Now, what you're finding out there, does that apply to many cities in the country?
Well, I think it does, but, I mean, Philadelphia is very blessed to have something like the Pew Center for Art and Heritage function as a major foundation with very scholarly and astute knowledge that helps elevate the practices of their independent artists, their major flagship institutions, design, heritage, libraries. When you look at some of what they have there, you know, we all have different footprints in American history, but Philadelphia is quite acute, obviously. And so I think that there are certain things that they do there that could be absolutely modeled and amplified around the country in different cities and communities. But there's also things there that are just so specific and unique to there that you have to really go there to be able to absorb them.
Can you tell us what you may have planned in the future at Royce?
We still have a huge number of projects that come from, you know, right now all the way to the close of the season's program in the spring. Highlight, I would say, in relation to that is Akram Khan and Israel Galvan with an extraordinary dance piece that look at Kathak-based Indian dance movement as well as art forms that Israel Galvan is deeply involved in with flamenco. He's one of the top flamenco dancers. Both of those dance forms have extraordinary footwork, and they find these shared rhythms together, and it's an amazing piece.
Thank you for giving us some of your time.
Thank you, Sheila, as always.
Christy Edmonds is the executive and artistic director for the Center for the Art of Performance at UCLA. That flamenco meets Indian dance program she said she's looking forward to takes place March 18th and 19th. For more details, visit cap.ucla.edu. And Edmonds spoke with KUSC contributor Sheila Tepper. And now, here's Gail Eichenthal with another musical mystery for Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music.
It's time for our weekly interactive Music 101, featuring Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music and his entire faculty at your disposal to answer your burning questions about music. Dean Rob, welcome.
Thank you, Gail.
We have a question today from Megan Franklin, and she wants to know, are there any classically trained singers who have careers that don't involve opera. What options are open to a good trained voice?
Ah, what an excellent question. I went actually to several members of our vocal arts faculty. I kind of knew the answer to this, but I wanted to get their take on it. And all of them enthusiastically said, well, of course there are people not in opera. It was funny. I ran into, right after this question, into Rod Guilfrey, who often is with the LA Opera regular there. I posed that to him, and he said, well, I love singing musicals. It is not that a person has to, who has a vocal arts degree, is going to definitely go into opera. Some of our students I talked with, one of them, Randall Bills, he's finishing his doctorate in vocal arts, so that's pretty doggone dedicated. He's actually in Germany right now with an opera company. So I mean, these are really high-quality people. A couple months ago, he gave me a CD of his where he's doing Christian pop songs, because he loves doing that. He has also done some songs for films here in town in many, many different styles. Another one of our students, Courtney Huffman, who is a graduate student in vocal arts, had just fallen in love with cabaret tunes and is doing cabaret songs really as part of her recitals now. So yes, the old day of the diva and everything except this one style of music, that really is not around the way it used to be, especially among the very, very talented people. The lines between the genres of music are getting a little softer than they were. So they cross over all the time.
And there are a lot of people in musical theater who have operatic training.
Absolutely.
And how can it hurt?
Yeah, no, it really can't hurt at all. And, you know, I want to take this even bigger. A degree in vocal arts, I think, is one of the most practical degrees at a university. Because think about what a student has to do. You think, oh, they're just learning to sing. No. They take a year of courses in acting, for example. They take three languages. They need to learn Italian, French, and German. They take courses repeatedly in diction. And so this will help with public speaking. So you have these people who know how to be on a stage, to know how to present themselves. They have great diction. They're multilingual in the so-called cultured languages. Then you add into that the discipline that's involved with that. Then they take their history and their gen ed courses. A vocal arts degree is one of the most well-rounded degrees a person can actually get. And it's so counterintuitive because you think, oh, it's so focused on just singing opera. But even when they have to get into what do the stories mean, there's so much history they need to learn to study for their parts. I actually think of all degrees, not just music degrees on campus, it'd be hard to find any other degree that would prepare you for so many life experiences.
Well, this is one area of music where you can keep doing it no matter how old you are, no matter how far away you get from the professional world of music. You can be in a community chorus,
sure.
You can be in your local professional chorus. You don't have to be an opera singer to get a great deal from a music degree in
voice. Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
All right. Thanks, Dean Robb. Great, great question. Great answer.
Thank you.
Do you have a question for Dean Robb Kudieta and his team of experts? Send an email to askthedean@kusc.org. Again, that's askthedean@kusc.org. Or you can submit a question on Twitter. We're @classicalKUSC and just use the hashtag KUSCAskTheDean. And that wraps up this edition of Arts Alive for this Saturday, the 6th of February. Next week, The Envelope, Please. It's our annual Oscars edition of the program. Film critic Kenneth Turan consults his crystal ball, and movie music expert John Burlingame weighs in on this year's unusual race for Best Score. It's next Saturday morning at 8 o'clock on Arts Alive. The technical director is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had help this week from KUSC's Gail Eichenthal and Alan Chapman. Thanks also to Sheila Tepper. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Have a great weekend.